Hello, my name is Supasani Sirapun and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by David Seltzer, neurobiologist and musician. Dr. Seltzer is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a student-initiated Clark Forum program titled Music, Math, and Mind, and he's also joining me today for an interview. Welcome, Dr. Seltzer.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. So can you elaborate on your double life as a neurobiologist and musician?
Oh, not really. I think you just work on whatever is interesting if you can. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can afford the rent and food and so on, and you just try to pursue your interests. I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a lot of relationship between doing one thing and another. Sometimes you do them and the relationships come out. They shake out of it.
Yeah. So along that same vein, how has being a musician impacted your scientific career?
Probably not in any direct way, but I think you have problems and challenges in the arts, and you also have them in the sciences. And then you learn how to deal with them. And then sometimes you can take a lesson from one of them and apply it to another. And the lessons could be very straightforward, like how do you concentrate when you run into, when there's an apparent brick wall in front of you? So are you taking any science classes?
I am. I'm taking data analytics right
okay.
now.
So sometimes you run into a problem where there's no obvious answer, no clear answer, and it might take a very long time, maybe longer than the semester, to work out an issue. And so you're already getting some idea that in science that can be required.
Yeah.
It's data science, but it's still science and it's
yeah.
logic and so on. And the same kind of thing can happen in the arts. I saw a collection of Michelangelo's Pietas. I was in Italy a few months ago, and they put three of them in one room, which is amazing. You know, you never see that. This is the statues of the Madonna and Christ, and holding Christ. And one of them, the last one, he wrote on the back of the statue, he writes, "Nobody knows how much blood was spilled." And I think I know what he meant. He meant nobody knows how hard it was to make the statue. You know, challenges and these kind of things are kind of similar between artistic challenges and challenges in scientific research.
Yeah, I definitely relate because I was classically trained in three different instruments as a child, but then I chose the scientific path.
Also in data. In Thai instruments?
No, unfortunately. It was piano, flute, and the violin.
Okay.
So.
But you listen to Thai classical music?
I do. I love it a lot. My mom loves it a lot, so we have it on in the house. Along with that, so music impacts so many people around the globe, even though we don't speak the same language or we're not the same gender and mm-hmm. we're not born in the same places. But what is it about music that makes it so universal?
I think it's quite likely that that singing singing and speech kind of grew up together in our history, but there are obviously animals like birds, most obviously that sing and don't use speech the way that we understand it. They communicate, but maybe not with the way that we communicate. And they sing, they use music. Whales may or may not have an advanced spoken language. That's not really clear, and it's probably going to differ according to which species and which group and which place and which time of year. But some of them sing and sing very long, complex songs. Can you repeat your question? I think I'm getting at it, but I just lost the train of it.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to ask you, in your opinion, what do you think it is about music that makes it so appealing universally around the world?
So why would whales and birds understand music and all human societies find some relationship to music? I think it is pre-human. I think that not necessarily every animal uses sound. I mean, can you define music for me? Since I think I would answer, I would address that question differently. We discuss it differently depending upon what you're thinking of as music.
Yeah, for me, I would define music as a harmonious collections of sounds.
So it has to be harmonious. Okay. And birdsong is music or it's not?
I would say it is, yeah.
It is. But some birds don't sound harmonious to us and maybe even to other members of their own species. Would that still be music?
Yeah. So maybe a collection of sounds would be a more apt definition.
So they should have a collection.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you had very limited sound abilities, that wouldn't be music. Hmm. I think, certainly, I'm not even sure it's certain. I think all vertebrates, are there vertebrates that don't, there's occasionally animals that people say are deaf. And then often that turns out not to be true. Even moths, right? Because, they don't hear anything like we do, but they perceive vibrations. Maybe the vibration is going through a stem that they're sitting on rather than through the air. So to us, it's imperceptible. And our sounds may be imperceptible to them unless it's shaking that stem. But then they are able to note that there are other moths nearby. It's a form of hearing because it's a form of sensing vibrations in a medium, I suppose. And so is that music to them? Out here, when you hear the crickets and the katydids at night, is that music or not?
I would say it's music because, at least to me as a human, I can perceive it and
okay.
hear it.
All right. I'm not being facetious. I'm just, the conversation gets deep.
Yeah.
So one more time on what the question was. The question was something like, why is music in every culture?
Yeah, why?
And now I'm thinking that your question, we could say it's even a bigger question than the one you just asked.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it spread through so many different living organisms, so many different species, and
exactly
so many. Yeah. Why would crickets and whales and moths and songbirds and Homo sapiens, why would they all respond to music? And if you look at it that way, then the idea that humans respond to music becomes almost like a smaller thing, because you go, who cares that the human is from Thailand or from Madagascar or from South Florida? Big deal. Why, they're not all that different. Why should there be, you said gender, what did you say that defines humans? You said gender was one.
Gender, age, nationality.
So it would be surprising to me if there were one of the genders didn't appreciate music, but they may appreciate it differently, mm-hmm. right? In humpback whales, the males, quote, sing. The females make sound too, but they don't have these long songs. So I'll rephrase your question. It's kind of, it makes it more obnoxious, which is why in some species, is it mostly the males who sing? It's clearly not true in our species and in a lot of other ones. And I think that gives you a clue to one of the uses of singing, which is in some species for males to attract female mates. But is that the whole thing? Doesn't seem likely. And there are some species of songbirds where both sexes sing, other ones where it's only males. Then you also said age. I can't think of why one age would like music more than others. Certainly in humans, I mean, there's abilities that go along with becoming virtuosic, say. And so people at different ages probably can execute some things better than others, depending upon. I mean, it's not always young people. Opera singers, they say, really start to get good after the age of 40. Composers, sometimes it could take a long time to develop because of the, depending upon the style of music, but some of it's very complicated and it takes a long time for people to get all the skills under their belt, so to speak. So you said gender, age, and what was the other reason?
Nationality.
Nationality. So where you're from. Yeah. Why would people be different in terms of nationality?
The way that I was thinking of it is, at least when I was born in Thailand, I wasn't exposed to a lot of Western pop and such. I was thinking of it more as, well, do people have different tastes from what they're exposed to as a child, from the region that they're born in?
There are definitely regional differences in musical preferences. I love the music in Isan. I think that that's very hypnotic. But of course, I have nothing to do with Isan other than visiting it. Isan, for listeners, is I would call it the poorer area, financially poorer area of Thailand. And it's... It perhaps in a related way, although it's kind of weird, that their music reminds me of the blues in America. It's kind of hypnotic, repetitive, pentatonic, as all Thai music is, but most essentially all Southeast Asian music. But very, very beautiful and can be very languid, can be exciting also, but it has a particular kind of sound. And some of that is, you know, where it's located. So they use these instruments like canes. Do you want to describe the cane?
I think you should do that. I don't know much.
The cane is a harmonica-like instrument that I think was developed by people in Laos. But it's been adopted by people in Isan. And it sounds to me, we can maybe play a little bit of it on your radio show. It kind of reminds me of the blues harmonica from the Deep South in the United States. So are there differences? Yeah. You know, North Thai music, Lana music sounds different than Isan, which sounds different than the South in Bangkok. Sure, there are regional differences, and that's just in one country. So all over the world, there are different things. And you were asking, do people fall in love with what they heard when they're children? And usually that's true. Usually, you know, say if a Thai person moves to the United States, they'll frequently get together with other Thai people and listen to Thai music. And if Americans move to Thailand, they'll do the analogous thing. And then some people remain curious and have the ability to learn. It's hard for me to understand it with humans, but so many of them, maybe this is more of a Western thing, they kind of fall in love with what they were listening to when they were in high school or maybe in college, and then they stick with it for the rest of their lives. And so you go 50 years later and they're still listening to the same favorite recordings from when they were 17. And, you know, I empathize with that a bit, but it's also hard for me to understand why people would want to cut themselves off from new experiences in the arts. It's hard for me to defend that, but that is what people do. And sometimes they get upset, and then you have this phenomena in the West where, you know, there's popular music from different generations, and the generations are maybe, you know, 20, 25 years, and the parents go like, I can't stand what the kids are listening to, and then their kids become parents, and they can't stand what their kids are listening to, and et cetera. And it all, I don't know, I mean, it's good to be aware of it, but from my perspective, it's kind of silly. I don't really get it. Are you like that?
I honestly...
Are you like that when you have kids? You're going to go like, I hate that stuff.
I mean, I am. I'm already starting to feel it a little bit. Actually, one of my questions was, do you think that pop music is headed in a downward direction because of the rise of TikTok and streaming and how it seems, at least to me, almost every artist wants that viral moment on social media?
That's such a deep, enormous question. We're going from like this really profound question about what animals and species and humans appreciate music and listen to the economics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's much harder to make a living as a musician now. And one way to make some of a living is to get a viral TikTok video. So, you know, people, I mean, I know a guy that does experimental music but claims to make a lot of money on TikTok, almost enough to make a living. So, yeah, people are desperate. Why are people desperate? Because it's harder to make a living. There was this short period. I think musicians throughout history have usually been kind of broke. And if I had to struggle. And then there was this period in the 20th century that everybody knows about where, you know, the, I don't know, like Frank Sinatra up through maybe 25 years ago, when people were becoming very, very wealthy doing pop music. And you know, a lot of people. And now it's down to, you know, Taylor Swift and three or four other, you know, you could play on a Taylor Swift record, but still not really be making a living 6 months later. You know, so it's things have changed economically. In a way, it's even worse. It's even harder than it was before all these recording technologies, you know. So I think there was a little sweet spot where people thought that they could probably make a lot of money. And it didn't last that long, maybe a couple of decades. And then it was kind of over. And now it's very, very hard to make a living. So I think that's why people are likely hungry for TikTok videos. I mean, people are always hungry for attention. And you make music to communicate. So everybody that makes music wants to communicate and would like people to hear it. Now, do they necessarily want the world's biggest audience? No, of course not. Some people, you know, some music is made for a small audience, and some small audiences might be listening, or much more involved in it than for a larger audience. In a way, I think there was, and maybe still, a tendency to, you know, want a large audience, mostly for economic reasons. If you're Taylor Swift, you can still genuinely be very wealthy. But I'm afraid there's a big gap between the tiny number of pop singers who are making a lot of money and a small number of producers, and then the many, many people that are otherwise making the music, and then all the people who devote their lives to making music, but simply, you know, are not going to get compensated for it. That's the world, and it's like I say, it's not exactly new. It's just I think it's even a little harsher now, and why? A whole bunch of reasons, mostly have to do with technology. You know, I can tell you that when I moved to New York City back in, you know, 40 years ago, there were lots and lots of places to perform live, and now there are fewer, and there are fewer and fewer. And why is that? Well, real estate being expensive, then, you know, people, there have been DJs for a long time, but there used to be, you know, some places would have DJs, other places would have live musicians, and DJing is a lot cheaper. You know, people don't, I think you could have live musicians playing at raves instead of a DJ, but it's just so much cheaper to bring in a DJ. And that some DJs make a hell of a lot of money, but that also is relatively transient, I think. I think they make a lot of money for a relatively short time. So, you know, to get a big sound, you used to have to get a lot of players. Now you can do it on your laptop, and the sound is as big as what people used to get with the enormous group. Or because of that, there used to be an industry in making movie soundtracks and commercial soundtracks with a lot of people employed, and that's almost completely disappeared. There's still some, but it's a tiny fraction of what it used to be. And there are other reasons too. So it used to be that when people, like say in the first 20, 30 years of sound movies, if you wanted a music track, you hired a composer and they brought in musicians, and then you had recording engineers and everybody else. Then later they started making libraries of music, and you could just buy a library and use that. And okay, maybe it's not as brilliantly appropriate to your story as bringing in somebody who wrote music specially for your film, but it's good enough to get by. And now with AI music, you can essentially write it for free without even, you know, before a laptop, until the last 3-4 years, 2 years. You needed some skill to be able to make laptop music, even if you were using Ableton Live, which is a program that essentially every DJ who creates their own music uses. It's a very good program. But, you know, you could do it very quickly and very cheaply. It's the cost of the program. You could come up with a lot. I use it myself. A lot of people use it. But with AI, you don't even need that. I mean, you still needed some skill to be able to do that. And now your skill is using a prompt. So, yeah, things are changing, and it's... I think I just had a very, very long-winded answer, or if not answer, at least discussion on your question.
Yeah, no, you completely answered it. And I actually had a question on here about AI, and I wanted to ask you, do you think it threatens the integrity of music nowadays? Or... a lot of people like to argue that it's a tool for newer people to get into music making, but also some argue that it completely loses the essence of what music making is.
It's from my perspective, it's a tool. It's a tool like using a piano, like using a violin or a cane or a flute or your voice. So it's another tool. It obviously also differs in a lot of ways because, like you said, I mean, you don't you don't really need to understand the nuts and bolts of how the music is put together. Another weird thing about it, and you can use this constructively, I released an AI album. I'm proud of it. It's a sarcastic Christmas music, so that when you're walking in a mall, instead of only hearing the Christmas hits, you also hear something that's kind of subversive, making fun of things. But it sounds like Christmas music, so unless you're listening carefully, you think it's just another Christmas song. If you listen to it carefully, you realize that it's very sarcastic. So, but that works right now well with AI, because AI, large language model, AI, can only, when I say only, it does it astonishingly well, but takes what's already been made and shuffles it. So there's some kinds of art you might want to do that is not part of already, you know, the works that are already extant. AI does not come up with that. It might be a tool that you can use to come up with something that hasn't existed. But I think most of the books written with AI and the art done with AI and the music done with AI essentially is kind of reshuffling what's already out there. Again, you can use it as a tool and do something very creative with it. People tend not to do that, but some of them are going to do that and they're going to come up with something great. So that's different than talking about the economics. The economics is obviously terrible for musicians. I think Spotify last week, so right now this is the end of September in 2025, I think Spotify last week said that they were taking down over 100 million AI created songs, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That, and how many people live in this country?
I actually do not know. I'm not from here.
That's 300 and something million. So okay. That's it's as if it's as if almost, you know, well, a third of the people in the country were making AI songs and putting them on Spotify. So yeah, it's a little overwhelming when you can make something that cheap that fast. I see that in videos. I don't know about you. It's not like I watch a lot of videos, but I'll see something on YouTube. It's like the history of some musician or something like that. And I go, oh, I'm a fan of that person. I'll put it on. And then I realize, I don't think anybody worked on this at all. Somebody said, you know, write me the hidden history of Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters is one of my favorites, a blues musician from the 1940s. And it's like, no, that wasn't even, there's no thought in this at all. That's just going through what's posted somewhere and chopping it up and getting some videos and outcomes. And I don't think anybody put any thought and care into it at all. So there's a lot of that. But then there are pieces that come out that are, use it as a tool and come up with something really, really unusual. I have a friend who just published a book that apparently is getting very bad reviews, but it doesn't mean it's not a fascinating book. He calls it Patchwork. His name is Tom Comita, C-O-M-I-T-T-A. I can't really read the book from beginning to end, but part of that is because every line in the book comes from other books. He didn't write anything. He just recombined them to tell a novel. It's very strange, but it's also very funny. And I don't know, the humor and the satire. He's not an AI, but I'm sure he must have used AI to search for some sentences out of hundreds of classic books in order to do this.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't know about that book. I think that's a really cool concept. I'll have to check it out later. We are ending to our time, so I have a fun question for you, or also very serious, depending how you look at it.
Unlike all your other questions?
Yeah, this could be a bit more lighthearted. Mm. If you could only listen to one artist for the rest of your life, who would it be?
Well, that's rough, but I just mentioned Muddy Waters, so maybe if you have music before or after this podcast, maybe put one or two of Muddy Waters' blues songs on.
I can do that. Well, this concludes our interview. So on behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down and having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.